This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. I hope you've enjoyed your bank holiday weekend. Later in the show, I'll be joined by Ash Sarkar. Before that, we'll be looking at the latest events in Israel, Palestine. And then coming up later, what I'll be talking with Ash about is more fallout from the local and mayoral elections, some very bizarre propaganda about pro-Palestine students in the United States, and the right-wingers who are fuming, and when I say fuming, absolutely fuming, that Sadiq Khan has been re-elected London mayor. Without further ado, let's go straight into our first story. Israel has ordered over 100,000 Palestinians to evacuate parts of Rafah in southern Gaza. This was Israeli spokesperson David Mentzer announcing the move.
In recent hours, the IDF has informed Gazans in eastern Rafah to evacuate temporarily towards the expanded humanitarian area. We have made Gazans aware through flyers dropped, SMS messages, phone calls, and media broadcasts in Arabic. The text of the flyers is available from the IDF website. They call on residents of certain specified neighborhoods to relocate to specified humanitarian safe zones because the IDF will be operating against the terrorist organizations in these areas.
Many people sheltering in the narrow zone on Egypt's border are already heeding that order, packing their belongings onto every available space on cars, bikes and carts. Displaced Gazans and Rafah residents have begun to flee the zone the Israeli government once described as safe. The evacuation order comes amid intensifying bombing of Rafah over recent days. And even with an evacuation order in place, Israeli airstrikes caused explosions this morning in eastern parts of the city as Gazans tried to leave the area. Palestinians are being told to leave eastern Rafah. That's the area marked in red here. They've been ordered to move through southern Khan Yunis, an area that was largely destroyed by intense bombing in January and February. And they're being told to move into the so-called humanitarian zone at Al-Mawasi. Now, that's located on the Mediterranean coast to the west of Khan Yunis. The Israeli government is describing the evacuation of 100,000 Palestinians out of Rafah as, quote, limited in scope. Of course, evacuation is only one name for it. Forced displacement would be another. And in an overnight phone call with US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant appeared to make clear that this is the beginning of a larger operation. The Times of Israel reports that Gallant told Austin that Israel had no choice but to press ahead with a Rafah offensive after a recent attack by Hamas. Now, that's a reference to Sunday's Hamas missile attack on Israeli troops stationed near the Kerem Salem border crossing between Gaza and southern Israel. It killed four IDF soldiers and injured 10. In a separate statement, Gallant linked the operation to a deadlock in ceasefire negotiations with Hamas, saying this morning in the center of the Gaza Strip, IDF forces are ready for a powerful operation all over Gaza and especially in the Rafah area. The order will arrive very soon. Hamas refuses any plan to return our abductees. The implications on the ground will be clear. Haaretz has also reported on a conversation between Gallant and Yehuda Cohen, whose son was taken captive by Hamas on October 7th. The paper reports this. Cohen said he asked Gallant if the government is ready to go for a ceasefire in exchange for the return of all the hostages, but that Gallant avoided answering the question. According to Cohen, Gallant then said that if we agree to a ceasefire, they will want more things. They also wanted Jerusalem. Gallant also said that negotiations under fire provide more results. That's according to Cohen. Military pressure is the only thing Israel has on Hamas, and ultimately, we will bring it to the point where we break it. We will stop everything if there is a deal, but right now, we are not able to achieve that. So that's words ascribed to Gallant. In response to the evacuation order, Hamas called the operation, quote, a dangerous escalation that will have consequences. But a leading Hamas source has now told Al Jazeera that the group has informed Egyptian and Qatari mediators that it will accept the current ceasefire proposal. Now, this is not a proposal from Israel. This is a proposal from Egypt and the Qataris. And it's not clear how Israel will respond to this latest move, nor whether it will be enough to stop its Rafah operation. We will be talking about this more across the show because it's not quite clear the significance of this, but it does seem to be significant. In the meantime, international leaders and humanitarian agencies have been warning against Israel attacking Rafah. And of course, around 1.4 million Palestinians are sheltering there. Now, some of those voices were out in force today. This is James Elder from UNICEF.
Absolutely devastating. You have families in Rafah. Their coping capacity has been smashed. This is 6 months of enduring this war, moving many times, probably having lost a home already. Children are malnourished. They've already been living in conditions with, you know, one shower for 3,500 people. They're being told to move, quote unquote, to a humanitarian zone. That's a unilaterally declared humanitarian zone. That's not a humanitarian zone where humanitarians have been able to provide the services they need to. So I've been talking to colleagues and friends in Rafah this morning, and they're terrified. I was speaking, Lauren, to a young woman. She's like, I know this has been coming. I just don't know what to pack. They'll go to an area in the middle zone, Lauren, called Deribala, where there is literally raw sewage in the streets, or maybe to Al-Mawasi, which is a beach. Same story applies. Nowhere is safe, but as unbearable as this is, it's happening and it's going to be horrific.
So for around 6 months now, the message from humanitarian workers, humanitarian agencies hasn't changed much, right? What's going on in Gaza is completely horrific. Every time Israel tells people to evacuate to a different area, they then get moved on again, or they get bombed and killed where they've been told to evacuate to. This is a similar message which we keep hearing from the likes of UNICEF. However, there's been one voice that's been noticeably silent, US President Joe Biden. Former foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders, Matt Duss, explained why that might be. What is happening in Rafah now appears to be a scenario some in the administration really feared, a slow motion operation that appears careful and targeted, but steadily blooms into full invasion. The goal is to force Washington, D.C. to waste time debating, is this really the invasion? But yes, it is. And the Biden administration has said repeatedly that they would not support an Israeli invasion of Rafah without a credible plan to protect civilians, which they have not yet seen, of course, because there isn't one. It's urgent for Biden to follow through and withhold US support for this invasion. According to reports, Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke on the phone just an hour ago. As you'd expect, it doesn't seem like much concrete has come out of it. This is from the White House on that conversation. President Biden updated the Prime Minister on efforts to secure a hostage deal, including through ongoing talks today in Doha, Qatar. And the Prime Minister agreed to ensure the Kerem Shalom crossing is open for humanitarian assistance for those in need. The President reiterated his clear position on Rafah. The Kerem Shalom crossing opens straight into eastern Rafah, so it's not clear what good keeping it open will do if the humanitarian aid is going straight into a very active war zone. And there are also growing fears that the new displacement of Palestinians out of Rafah will go unseen by Israeli citizens. That's after the Israeli government voted this weekend to shut down Al Jazeera in Israel. At least one office has already been closed, with the Washington Post reporting that Israeli officers confiscated broadcasting equipment from an Al Jazeera office in occupied East Jerusalem. The shutdown will mean that Al Jazeera cannot broadcast in Israel, while some staff have had their accreditation withdrawn. It's not yet clear what it will mean for transmission to the occupied West Bank or how it will affect Al Jazeera's reporting from Gaza. Now, earlier today, and I have to say this was just before Hamas said it had accepted the ceasefire deal on offer, I spoke to Daniel Levy, an incredibly interesting guy, British-Israeli analyst who was part of Israel's negotiating team during the Oslo process. And I started by asking him whether he thinks this latest order from Israel is the starting gun for a full-scale invasion of Rafah.
Netanyahu has an intention of conducting a full-scale operation in Rafah unless sufficiently dissuaded not to do so. In effect, the Israeli military has been treading water in Gaza for several months. That doesn't mean that the Palestinian civilian population in Gaza haven't had the most horrendous time of things. There have been mass kill events almost every day. The devastation, of course, is there. There was not the mobilization, the troop availability to conduct a significant ground operation. That has now been addressed in the last weeks. And I think Israel's military is somewhere close to being ready for that. I don't think there will necessarily be a full-scale invasion from the get-go. I also would suggest that we bear in mind throughout this that Netanyahu wants this war to continue. This is supposed to be a long war, a forever war. He doesn't want to face the music of the morning after. We have known this. It's not news. Delaying Rafah, making Rafah a quite drawn-out affair, is therefore not out of sync with how Netanyahu would like to conduct this. Once Israel has gone into Rafah, it will take some time, that military operation. I don't think it's going to be any more stunningly successful than the rest of this war has been. I don't think it's gone that well for Israel on the battlefield. But Israel then faces the question, Netanyahu faces the question of, what do you do next? So in other words, we are seeing the beginning of an operation that will not necessarily kick on in a major fashion in the coming days. That might still take several more weeks. It's Israel's Independence Day a week from now. So I don't think this is the beginning of the launching of the full-scale invasion, but I do think that is on the horizon. Unless something else serves to prevent it from happening, I do not think we're at that place yet, either domestically or internationally, and especially not in the extent to which the US is putting pressure to avoid it.
It's interesting to hear you say sort of militarily this operation hasn't gone well for the Israelis, because I mean, I think it's clear to most people how diplomatically sort of they've incurred huge costs, especially in terms of sort of world public opinion, if not sort of the actual actions of their allies. But Israel's sort of military activity, I mean, it seems like the Israelis have taken fewer losses than some people were predicting at the start of this, and presumably, I mean, it seems like it is difficult to quantify, but one would imagine that Hamas is significantly weakened as a fighting force. What makes you say that this has been militarily not particularly successful on the part of the Israelis, what we've seen over the past 6 months now?
You're right. Let's acknowledge that there are reputational, legal, political, diplomatic, image things that aren't part of that equation. Why do I therefore assert that on the military front? First of all, there's October 7th. The illusion, the myth of invincibility is shattered in quite horrific ways. It is shattered. The intel question, the first response question. Then Netanyahu and the Israeli leadership set a bar, which is a very, very high bar indeed, in terms of the total eradication, dismantling of Hamas. What we have seen is that once the Israeli military has lessened its presence in any given area, Hamas has still been there. Hamas fighting forces have been there. Now, it is true that Hamas's military capacity has been diminished, has been weakened. What Hamas prepared for in terms of the really quite large brigades, Al-Qassam brigades, those have been depleted. They have not been annihilated. Hamas's ability to act as a resistance is still very much in place. The tunnels go in different directions, so Hamas personnel are not necessarily all waiting in Rafah. But then there are other pieces to this, because one has to remember that, you know, the fact that Israel conducted this mission in a way that caused so much devastation and destruction. Now, most people who plan urban intense warfare will tell you that if you want to turn the entire population against you for generations, you conduct the kind of indiscriminate, disproportionate actions that Israel has undertaken. And so forth. So what you tend to do is you put your infantry, you put your military in harm's way and conduct close combat fighting. Israel has avoided doing that. I think that raises a lot of questions for a lot of people as to the confidence they have, as to their ability to sustain losses. And this is Hamas, remember. This is a force operating out of an area that has been besieged, that's been under a blockade for a decade and a half. This isn't Hezbollah, this isn't Iran, this isn't the Houthis. So I think those are the kinds of questions that are being raised. It is important what you mentioned, that the Israeli losses, if you do the count, have not been huge. What that doesn't factor in, and it's worth mentioning, is there are some really horrific injuries. There are people with life-changing injuries. And one of the factors here is that this isn't Britain or the US in Afghanistan or Iraq, where the evacuation of someone badly injured to a field hospital means that many many soldiers wouldn't make it. In Israel, you're a five-minute helicopter ride from the top military, sorry, the top hospitals that you know anywhere can offer. And so I think a lot of people have been saved, but they have got very nasty injuries, and they're aware of that. And so one of the things going into this Rafah operation is you have people in the military saying, Rafah is not going to be easy. Just as Israel has learned from what Hamas has done elsewhere, the opposite is true. Hamas is prepared for this. Both sides are prepared for this. There will be some nasty surprises as far as the IDF is concerned. There's a lot of talk of burnout. There's a lot of people whose families have said, if you do this, the hostages won't come out. So there is opposition also inside the military and also for military reasons to going into Rafah.
I want to focus in on something you said a moment ago about sort of movement going in both ways in these tunnels, because I suppose the mental image that many people have, and I think I've had it myself to some degree, is that what this war has been doing is sort of invading from the north, sort of defeating Hamas to some degree, sort of clearing the ground. I was imagining that they were to some degree sort of trying to destroy the tunnels. And so the image is that they've pushed everyone into this sort of small corner of Gaza, Rafah. And then we imagine that sort of, well, you know, by a process of elimination, Hamas leaders must be in the tunnels under Rafah, and the hostages must be in the tunnels under Rafah. But you're suggesting that actually it's quite possible that they're still in tunnels sort of all over Gaza. Am I understanding that correctly?
I'm speculating that might be the case, Michael. I can't know, and I don't know. What we do know is that Israel has made it public that the dismantling of this tunnel infrastructure, they claim, will take a long period of time. That these are booby-trapped, of course. These aren't supposed to be highly amenable and convenient to being permanently dismantled by, you know, the military that goes in and tries to conduct that mop-up operation. So it is not unreasonable to speculate that there are still usable tunnels that go in multiple directions. And I don't think Rafah has been sealed underground. Like I say, I can't know that for sure.
Let's talk about negotiations. I mean, it almost felt like deja vu this weekend, because you had over the weekend, sort of, I saw lots of headlines sort of saying signs that progress has been made in negotiations between Hamas and Israel. And then by Monday, you've got an escalation. It seems like, oh, actually, that was all just a mirage. How should we interpret this sort of constant cycle of speculation? Oh, progress is about to be made. Oh, actually, none whatsoever has been made. Do you know what? It feels a bit like Groundhog Day. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
For an awfully long time now, Hamas has had a quite consistent position, which is that any pause, any beginnings of an agreement for hostages to be released in exchange for some movement, some greater freedom of movement of people inside Gaza, the release of some Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails, significant upscaling of humanitarian assistance. This package, redeployment out of Gaza of the IDF, this package is the on-ramp to a sustained calm, a sustainable ceasefire. Now, Israel was at war with the Palestinians prior to October 7th. So, you know, when I also find myself saying permanent ceasefire, one just has to pause. This isn't the end of Israel's belligerent occupation, and therefore war by definition continues when you are a belligerent occupying power. But that what we have seen in the last 6 months will reach a sustained ceasefire. That has been the consistent Hamas position. The consistent Israeli position of Prime Minister Netanyahu and his cabinet ministers has been that there can be a pause in order to achieve the release of some of the hostages, but then Israel will resume its military assault on Gaza, and here specifically into Rafah. Why then was there this kind of frisson of excitement that maybe we were going to be seeing a deal? I think a couple of things happened. I think there is a degree of desperation from some of the parties. There's desperation from the families of the hostages for very understandable reasons. I think the Egyptians were getting quite nervous that if Rafah happens, they're much more exposed. Perhaps on the American side, President Biden is looking not at Palestinian casualties, but is looking at the tumult inside America. The Chicago Convention is looming. If Israel goes into Rafah, then this guarantees the war continues for some months. I'm told he has an election in November and that's not going swimmingly well. So he might be thinking about that. So you had those things going on in the background. Then what was happening in the mediation? What was happening in the mediation was two things. Number one, there was certain movement on the granular details of what might happen during a pause. The conditions under which Palestinians could move back to the north of Gaza, for instance, where would Israeli troops be, and more importantly, for Hamas not be? That kind of thing. Secondly, crucially, there was a sense that maybe the US was getting on board with being a guarantor that a period of calm would not be followed by a resumption of this full-scale aggression and a rougher invasion. Prime Minister Netanyahu made clear every day, he came out and said, whether there's a deal or not, I'm going to do Rafah. So he is intentionally, and this is what much of the commentary act in Israel, this is what the hostage families, many of them are coming out and saying, was making it very clear that this particular reading of the intention was not one he accepts. And then you had a moment of decision. Would the US make it very clear that it was leaning into this guarantor role, that it is saying absolutely no way rougher, or would it fill its mouth with water, be, you know, finding linguistic acrobatic formulations to try and dodge the issue? And we saw that in the readout from the White House of Netanyahu and Biden's latest call, where Biden apparently repeated, this is what they've said in public, that the position on Rafah is known. Spell it out if it's known. And the US administration did not step up to the plate. And I think Netanyahu, if I can just be blunt, is basically off the hook. And I think a lot of people look at this and they say, wait a minute, are you saying that the Hamas negotiating position was more reasonable than Israel's? Because that's really hard for me to get my head around. And that is what we're saying. Because if Hamas said, we will continue to launch rockets on Israel, people will say, well, that's bonkers. Why would you go into this? But Israel is saying, we're going to conduct the operation in Rafah. And that's also bonkers. Why would you go into this? But until the West and the US in particular has the, not just the gumption, but the honesty to call out Israel, then all you will have is the hostage families, some protesters in Israel, and of course the Palestinians pointing out that Netanyahu is the one preventing a deal.
Do you have a sense of why the Americans aren't doing that? Because, I mean, you know, they do have the power to tell Israel not to go into Rafah and that we need some sort of sustainable ceasefire. You know, I can't imagine that there would be that much pushback from the American electorate if he did that, and then sort of other sections of the American electorate might sort of, you know, reward him for having disciplined Israel. Why won't they do that? Do they sort of secretly think that actually it would be helpful for Israel to go into Rafah for some military reason that they don't want to sort of say publicly? What's your read on this?
At this stage, I do think the idea that the administration, you know, actually wants this to happen, it wants the region to still be on a knife's edge, it wants the possibility of tipping into a broader escalation, which we walked quite close to that edge between Israel and Iran. It wants the IDF to prove that it can't dismantle Hamas and to be, you know, faced with what we talked about earlier, with being a little more exposed as not quite being that military that people had it written down as being. I'm not seeing that. You know, I am fundamentally convinced, you know, of the nefarious nature of the military-industrial complex as much as the next sane person. But I don't think that particular desire exists in the administration. So how do you explain it? And the best I can do, because I scratch my head quite a lot, you know, and scream at the screen, why are you still taking this position? The best I can do is to suggest the following. Number one, they know in the administration that if they are going to stare down Israel on this issue, it is going to require a sustained standoff. In other words, one poorly sourced Axios article that says the Americans may be delaying certain weapons transfers that has neither been confirmed nor denied by the administration. You would have to do that and confirm it and stand by it and justify it in a sustained fashion. I think that does the job, by the way. I think once you do that, it changes the dynamic in the Israeli military sufficiently. It changes dynamics in the Israeli public and politics, but it doesn't happen overnight. And I think they look at that and they say, do we want this fight? Because then that takes you into the other arena, which is how do they read their own politics? And apparently they read their own politics based on a playbook, which I think is dramatically out of date. In terms of do you induce the ire of the Israel lobby? How does that impact your fundraising? What is the centrality of fundraising versus voter motivation, enthusiasm, get out the vote campaigns in an election? How much does that floating vote over Israel stack up alongside progressive voters, progressive Jewish American voters, Muslim American voters, Arab and Palestinian American voters, black voters, people who have any kind of moral compass around these issues, who are really taking a long, hard look at how this is playing out. So all I can suggest is that their political calculus still errs on the side of this costs us more than it gains.
That was Daniel Levy speaking to me earlier today. Now, as I said before, that interview was filmed before news of Hamas accepting a ceasefire deal. And as we were playing you that interview, it appears talk of a ceasefire deal have already been quashed. So this is an update from Al Jazeera we can read to you. An unnamed Israeli official quoted by Reuters news agency says Hamas approved a softened Egyptian proposal that is not acceptable to Israel. The official added that the proposal included far-reaching conclusions that Israel will not support. Israeli media outlets are also reporting that the Israeli government has not accepted the deal. And then this is from Al Jazeera, a reminder we do not have the specifics of the deal that Hamas has agreed to. And then we've also got an update from Israel's Channel 12 News. And so they quote a cabinet official as saying, Hamas announcement is a deception designed to present Israel as recalcitrant. So I think ultimately this leaves us in the same situation that Daniel Levy was describing in that interview, which is that Hamas is saying they want a ceasefire only if they have guarantees that that won't be followed by an invasion of Rafah, and Netanyahu saying we won't agree to any ceasefire that means we don't get to ultimately invade Rafah. So, I mean, the details here will emerge, but it seems to me that Hamas agreed to what the Israelis have called a softened ceasefire deal, which would have given some guarantees that a ceasefire wouldn't be followed immediately by an invasion of Rafah. And Israel have said, that's not the ceasefire that we said we would agree to because we want to invade Rafah. So essentially, again, as we were saying in the interview, this is Groundhog Day. We're still back where we have been with these negotiations ever since the first ceasefire broke down in November, which is Israel saying, we want a pause so you can release the hostages before we destroy you. Hamas saying, well, if you're just going to destroy us anyway, we're not going to release the hostages. And round we go. Meanwhile, of course, lots of people having their lives destroyed. Let's move on to something very different now. Last week's local election results show that the Conservatives are at the end of the road. But Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is still trying to put a positive spin on things. He's told the Times that the results actually reveal that Britain will face a hung parliament at the upcoming general election. He's told the Times that the results actually reveal that Britain will face a hung parliament at the upcoming general election. And he said this: these results suggest we are heading for a hung parliament with Labour as the largest party. Keir Starmer propped up in Downing Street by the SNP, Liberal Democrats and the Greens would be a disaster for Britain. And he is really trying to put on here this same sort of campaigning message that we heard from David Cameron back in 2015. So if you vote Labour, we will have a coalition of chaos. They'll be sort of in hock to the Greens and the SNP. Well, back then, of course, it was the SNP. The problem for Rishi Sunak is that was a lot more plausible in 2015 than it is now. And that's because his hung parliament prediction is based on just one analysis. So it's called the National Equivalent Vote, and it's an estimate of how the votes given in the local elections translate into a share of the national vote. Now, on that analysis, Labour is just 7 points ahead of the Tories. That is a margin that probably wouldn't give Labour a majority. But that goes against recent opinion polls that gives Labour a margin of around 20 points. Now, on Radio 4, pollster John Curtis explained why Sunak's prediction was more than a little ropey.
Let me give you three things to think about. The first is that it's quite long been the case, certainly since the late 1980s, that the way that people vote in local elections doesn't necessarily exactly mirror the way that they would vote in a general election, at least in terms of levels of support. And that particularly the Liberal Democrats have long since done better since then. And it tends to be Labour that suffer more as a result. And then more recently, the Greens certainly do better in local elections. And of course, we've also seen independents do well. So there's a point about levels. Now, that said, what does tend to be true is that the ups and downs of party performance in local elections, i.e. whether they're up or down since last time, does tend to reflect the changes in the opinion polls. So they, essentially, you should be looking at the change rather than the level. That's point one. A lot of commentary being made about Scotland. Certainly, in Scotland, at the moment, the latest poll suggested Labour Party might pick up 28 seats. Now, to be honest, Scotland on its own wouldn't make enough of a difference. There would probably Labour, if you took Colin and Michael's projection and add another 25 seats for Labour in Scotland, they're still just short of 326. But there's then a third very particular reason at the moment why we should be wary of these projections, and that is the position of Reform. We know from the opinion polls that Reform are now taking more votes off the Conservatives than Labour is. Two, Reform only appeared in 1 in 6 of the wards. So therefore, their impact was probably diminished. And certainly what you discover, if you take the wards where Reform did stand and look at what happened to the Conservative vote in those, the answer is that the Conservative vote was down by 19 points, which is exactly what you would expect in terms of a change in level. Given the change in the opinion polls in May 2021, when the seats being contested on Thursday were last contested, and where we are now. In other words, once you're looking at places where Reform are on the ballot paper, and as they threaten to be in the parliamentary election, the change in support for the parties looks remarkably like what you might expect.
That was a very sort of detailed analysis by John Curtis. I think it's actually a bit simpler to explain why this is a bit of a nonsense news line from Rishi Sunak, which is those national projected vote shares are saying, how would people have voted if there were local elections in every constituency in the country? And of course, people in local elections vote very differently to how they do in general elections. That's why in local elections, you have quite a lot of independents winning, right? Because people often think they can either do a protest vote or that an independent has a chance of winning in a local election, whereas they generally don't in a general election. So one of the problems here was that Sky News, they sort of get this national vote share projection, and then they say this is a projection for the general election. I think it was just sort of stupid journalism, actually, which we told you on Friday's show. I don't know what the Beth Rigbys of the world were doing, sort of sharing this idea that this means there will be a hung parliament at the next general election. For sort of the political fallout of these local elections, let's look at a comment from one of Sunak's political rivals, former Home Secretary Suella Braverman, was on the BBC Sunday with Laura Koonsbergen. Here's what she had to say.
The plan's not working, and I despair at these terrible results. There's no spinning these results. There's no disguising the fact that these have been terrible election results for the Conservatives, and they suggest that we are heading to a Labour government, and that fills me with horror. I love my country, I care about my party, and I want us to win. And I'm urging the Prime Minister to change course, to, with humility, reflect on what the voters are telling us, and change the plan and the way that he's communicating and leading us.
If it's that dire, why not change the leader?
Listen, I just don't think that's a feasible prospect right now. We don't have enough time, and it's impossible for anyone new to come and change our fortunes, to be honest. There's no Superman or Superwoman out there who can do it. Rishi Sunak has been leading us for about 18 months. He's been making these decisions. These are the consequences of those decisions. He needs to own this, and therefore he needs to fix it.
She's saying Rishi Sunak's not going anywhere, but also he's a complete idiot. Sort of strange, strange form of campaigning. I suppose she's saying he needs to get much more right-wing and be like me. And presumably it's more about a pitch of she wants to lead the Conservative Party after Sunak loses the next general election. Speaking for Sunak's government on Laura Koonsberg's show was Transport Secretary Mark Harper.
These are comments from some of your own council leaders who've lost. Andrew Jeffries, former council leader of Thurrock Council, he said people were unhappy with the government. They didn't like the message that was coming out, the plan. So that's one of your own side who lost this week. He's saying they don't like the national plan. Another, Andrew Baggett, who was leader of Basildon Council, he said there's a real immense dissatisfaction with people on the ground. What do you say to them? You're just not going to change anything.
No, what I would say is the plan is about delivering it. The plan is working. But we haven't. Well, but we haven't got all the way through to the end of it yet. So, for take inflation, it was 11% when the Prime Minister became Prime Minister. It's now down to 3.1. It's not all the way down to the Bank of England's target of 2, when they'll start being able to cut interest rates, which will make a huge difference to hardworking families. We've done part of the plan on dealing with illegal migration. It's down by 30% year on year at a time the number of illegal migrants coming to the European Union was up. But we haven't completed that plan yet. We've got the Rwanda legislation through Parliament, opposed every step of the way by the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats. You voted against it hundreds of times. Now we have it on the books. We can now get the flights going to Rwanda, a steady rhythm of flights. That will change the incentives there. It will have a deterrent effect.
So after,
and we'll continue delivering on that policy.
So after about these delivery. Results, so after these results, Mark Harper, and people will know and appreciate that you're a loyal minister, but after these results, you're not going to change anything. You're just going to stick to the plan, to use your phrase.
Well, we have a plan and the plan is working.
It's completely bizarre that they sort of think they can base a whole general election campaign and sort of, you know, you're 20 points behind in the polls and say, we're going to recover this by one quite niche and strange policy to send a few people to Rwanda. I mean, they've already sent one person, but they paid them $3,000 to do so. Ash, welcome to the show. I'm sorry to keep you waiting. I suppose I want your comment on this sort of Rishi Sunak trying to rerun David Cameron's argument in 2015 by saying to vote for the Labour Party is to vote for a coalition of chaos. And actually, I've seen people from all parts of the political spectrum sort of share this equivalent national vote share sort of projection from Sky and the BBC, which frankly, I don't even know why they bother doing it. I think it's just completely misleading because people don't vote in general elections like they do in local elections. And the fact that Labour have a 20-point poll lead to me seems much more relevant than the fact that quite a lot of people voted for independence in the most recent local elections. What do you think?
I mean, to take your questions in reverse order, why were so many people from across the political spectrum sharing that vote share projection? It's because our media culture is so hungry for new information and new narratives and new projections that you don't want to stop and go, does this smell like bullshit or does this seem like something relatively straightforward? And I also think a lot of journalists don't see it as their job to stress test the data that crosses their desks. They just want to get it out there and be the first person to come up with a new kind of angle, which is obviously quite a bad media culture. And I think that there's a sort of, you know, and I'm saying this as an arts and humanities graduate myself, there's a sort of intimidation effect when people talk about stats and data and anything to do with women in STEM. You're like, oh, well, that sounds really, really smart, but I also don't have the critical faculties to get my head around it. So people back off from it and they don't interrogate it like they should. And I'm sure that at some point I will make that same clanging error, not because I am palling around with lobby journalists, but because I am a similarly airheaded arts and humanities grad. As for what's being said around Rishi Sunak, one of the things that really struck me this weekend is that Rishi Sunak's government, you know, him at the top, bolstered by Jeremy Hunt, they're really more of a crisis management team with a parliamentary wing than a real political faction. You know, he got his ass handed to him by Liz Truss when he went up against her in the membership vote. He was nobody's first choice of prom date, and really he's been brought in to tidy up. And he's overseeing a party which is, I think, deeply wounded and traumatized by its own self-inflicted disasters. most recently, of course, being Liz Truss, her disastrous mini budget, the biggest mini budget of all time, which had a horrible impact on interest rates and contributed to the cost of living crisis. And before that, Boris Johnson's reckless waste of an 80-seat majority. Over the weekend, I went back and I looked over the poll tracker. So it shows you the answers to the Westminster voting intention question over time. And the point of crossover where the Conservatives dipped below Labour was December 2021. So that's really quite a long time ago. That's Boris Johnson, you know, ensconced in office. And I think that he completely lacked any of the skills to turn the Conservatives polling around, because he's a man who doesn't have political vision. He's a man with exceptional political branding. And I think that that is, you know, just clear from his electoral performances, whether as, you know, mayor of London or ultimately winning the Conservative leadership contest and then winning the 2019 election. Spectacular at political branding, terrible at political vision and a sense of here's what I'm going to do in a way which is strategic, not for the country, because I'm not sitting here going, why won't Boris Johnson do good things for the country? I'm talking about what is politically strategic in the interests of the Conservative Party. He really wasn't interested in that kind of thinking. So when the polls started dipping, he had no inner reserve of seriousness or strategy or ideas that could turn it around. In fact, he became, you know, even worse in his judgment, even more sort of, you know, selfish and vibes led. And I think that that's the difference between, you know, quite a dangerous Boris Johnson and a dangerous Conservative Party as well. When you had that vote leave strategy being ruthlessly implemented. And then when all the vote leave people either, you know, resigned or got sacked, basically there was a kind of palace coup, no more Lee Kane, you know, no more Dominic Cummings. The Conservative Party is completely unmoored from any ideas or any sense of how it's going to keep together its own electoral coalition. So Rishi Sunak has inherited a lot of those problems of political positioning. He also doesn't have strong status within the party. And the only reason why he's still there, and this is the bit that Suella Braverman couldn't say, is because nobody fucking wants that job. Nobody wants to be the prime minister who leads the Conservatives into what might be one of their worst general election defeats ever. Better to come in at the end of it and say, oh, well, that car crash happened because, you know, they weren't following my advice, rather than being the politician who is parked behind the wheel, you know?
The Tories' terrible electoral strategies has served them badly in two of Britain's biggest cities, or Britain's two biggest cities, in fact. Let's go to those results. So in London, Sadiq Khan won a historic third term as London mayor. He took around 44% of the vote, an increase of nearly 4% on the last election. The Tory candidate, Susan Hall, took just under 33% of the vote, a drop of 2.5% on 2021's result. The campaign was a sometimes bitter one, with Khan regularly objecting to what he saw as underhand tactics by Susan Hall. And the tone of the Tory campaign was something he referred to in his acceptance speech.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, London. It's the honour of my life to serve the city that I love. And I'm beyond humbled right now. I want to express my deep gratitude to my fellow Londoners, and make this pledge to you. I promise to repay the trust you've placed in me by working tirelessly to deliver the fairer, safer, and greener London you deserve. It's been a difficult few months. We faced a campaign of non-stop negativity, but I couldn't be more proud that we answered fear-mongering with facts.
He seems really pissed off, or really pissed off at Susan Hall. You know, he was essentially, once again, it's not a coincidence, he keeps being subject to pretty dog-whistly campaigns. And the one by Zach Goldsmith, you probably remember. Zach Goldsmith was, you know, everyone thought he was this sort of Tory liberal centrist. They did sort of articles in the Mail where they had a blown-up London bus. really awful. Let's look at Susan Hall's concession speech. She didn't hide her dislike for London's re-elected mayor.
The thing that matters to the most, and to me, is reforming the Met and making London safe again. I hope Sadiq makes this his top priority. He owes it to the families of those 1,000 people who have lost lives to knife crime under his mayoralty. And I hope, too, that he stops patronising people like me who care. This isn't an episode of The Wire. This is real life on his watch. I will continue to hold Sadiq to account, to stand up for the hard-working families, to motorists and to women. I love London and I urge Sadiq to try harder to make it better for all our sakes.
I mean, she didn't hold him to account, right? Like, for one, Sadiq Khan, I mean, it's historic in the sense that he's been elected for a third time. But if you look at, you know, his results compared to Labour's nationwide results and the fact that Labour are very popular in London, it's not an exactly, you know, it's not that impressive from him, that electoral performance. What was very notable here is how poor Susan Hall's campaign was. You know, like Sadiq Khan had actually quite an easy ride because she was an idiot and sort of everyone recognised that. So the idea she was holding Sadiq Khan to account sounds a little bit off to me. There was a mayoral election with a very different tone. It was the one which took place in the West Midlands. Labour's Richard Parker narrowly beat the incumbent Tory mayor Andy Street. Parker took 37.8% of the vote compared to Street's 37.5%. You really can't get much closer than that. And the closeness of the result was a reflection of the closeness of the candidates. This was Richard Parker accepting the mayoralty.
First and foremost, thank you. I want to thank all of the staff at each polling station and at every count. Thank you for your hard work. And thank you also to Andy. You've led this region through a number of great challenges and you deserve great credit for that. You deserve credit through building up the combined authority into the powerhouse that it is today, through the economic shocks and leading this region when it came out of COVID. You've been out there representing our region, and I absolutely believe that whilst our politics are different, Andy, we both have the best interests at the West Midlands at heart.
Very, very different to what you just saw when they announced the results of the London mayoralty. And the warmness of the Labour winner was really sort of repeated by the loser, Andy Street, although he only lost for a very small amount, of course. This is Andy Street conceding the election and handing over the role he'd held for two terms.
Of course, I should thank Richard, indeed, for how he's conducted himself in the campaign and should congratulate him on his victory and, most importantly, wish him all strength and wisdom as he takes on this role.
So, Ash, some real contrast there. I mean, it does seem like for the West Midlands mayoralty, the two candidates sort of, you know, might have, it would seem like maybe they voted for each other, not themselves. You know what I mean? They seemed so positive about the other one. And then in London, you can just see that Sadiq Khan and Susan Hall absolutely despise each other. What should we take away from that?
I mean, look, the reason why it's a lot more acrimonious in London is because Sadiq Khan has been made a hate figure by both the mainstream Conservative Party and the far right. So simply because he's Muslim, he is being, you know, framed as close to Islamists, you know, Islamists run London, and being held accountable for knife crime in a way which is completely out of proportion for what you would expect from any politician. Not saying there aren't criticisms to make, but the ones which are being lobbed at him are very, very racialized. You, of course, had Zach Goldsmith running what I believe to have been a quite racist electoral campaign against Sadiq Khan, trying to connect him to the 7/7 bombers. And I think Susan Hall, particularly when she was trying to, you know, have a very, you know, culture wars plus anti-ULEZ led campaign, there was a sense that there was a bit of flirtation with the far right. And I think if you're Sadiq Khan, who's experienced an awful lot of racism, you know, threats to his physical safety, you're going to take that personally. I mean, I was half expecting him to grab the mic and, you know, be like, I hate the way that you walk, the way that you talk, I hate the way that you dress. Just, you know, it's the weekend of the diss track and I really, really wanted Sadiq Khan to deliver there. The thing which I did want to say, though, is I got a little bit of insight into how the press briefing operation worked around Sadiq Khan over the weekend. So it was being briefed by Sadiq Khan's team that it was going to be a very, very closely run mayoral election between him and Susan Hall. And the reason why teams brief that is because they want people to feel panicky enough to turn out the vote, which would benefit Sadiq Khan. Now, he enjoyed the pretty comfortable polling lead above Susan Hall throughout the campaign. I thought this doesn't pass the smell test. Then after the polls themselves closed, and it was the period in between the polls closing and the result being announced, there was a briefing operation from Sadiq Khan's team saying that, you know, she might actually have this one. It's looking very close. Turnout was down in these inner London boroughs. And again, I'm receiving these WhatsApp messages and I was like, this just isn't passing the smell test. Like it just isn't. What was hilarious to me was not long after receiving those texts, which are being briefed to journalists by the press team, outcome journalists repeating exactly this briefing, nearly word for word, but just sort of putting a little bit of their own spin on it or, you know, adding some data to bolster it. And it was in real time watching journalists regurgitate something that is just coming from the press team of a politician. So then when Sadiq Khan not only, you know, wins by a comfortable margin the London mayoralty, as expected, but also increases his own majority, which, you know, for multiple consecutive terms is basically unheard of. This should sort of tell you about what was going on here. What Sadiq Khan's team wanted to do is make sure that whatever the result was, it made Sadiq Khan look good. If his majority was reduced, then he could say, well, it was very, very close run thing. You should all just be grateful that I beat her. And then obviously, if his majority is increased, he looks like an incredibly talented wizard of a politician. That's the job of the press team to do that kind of thing. But it's utterly ridiculous that, you know, many journalists, including ones who are, you know, considered to be very well respected, were just repeating that briefing. It was so funny to me.
Ash, there's another talking point that's sort of come out of these elections, not so much from London, but more elsewhere, that I really want your viewpoint on. And it was sort of based on this idea that Labour were taking a hit in heavily Muslim areas. That's not just an idea, actually, that was a fact. And it has sparked a bit of a moral panic. So this was Sky's Trevor Phillips speaking on Sunday.
If I may say so, one of the things that this is showing is that there's a kind of politics, identity politics, which we are not used to. We're used to people clashing in politics because of what they believe on the economy, on redistribution, and so on and so forth. We're not used to people choosing their politics based on who and what they are, their religion or race or anything like that. Now, that is foreign to us, but I don't think it's something that we've seen the last of.
The thing that sort of instantly came to mind with this moral panic is sort of the idea of sort of Muslims voting as a bloc has always been, well, they'll have their socially conservative values and sort of they'll all of these rights that women have in Britain, they'll undermine as a voting bloc. This has only come up because Muslim votes disproportionately wanted to stop a genocide, right? Doesn't seem like something to be too panicked about. But what I really wanted to go to you, Ash, because I know you're sort of, you think about this a lot, is Trevor Phillips' idea that no one before has ever voted based on their identity. Before, it's always been based on their opinion on economics. And we've never had identity-based voting in Britain before.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a load of fraff, isn't it? I mean, just cast your mind back to the 2019 general election. One of the biggest news stories at that time, of course, was anti-Semitism. You had no shortage of front-page news stories talking about the breakdown of a voting relationship between the Jewish community and the Labour Party. And the interpretation that they were giving to that was that it was all because of Jeremy Corbyn and the accusations of anti-Semitism that dogged him. So when Jewish people were not voting for Labour, I don't recall Trevor Phillips saying, well, people voting as a bloc on the basis of who they are rather than the policies, that's completely foreign, you know, very saddening and essentially driving a moral panic. No, what I remember is that the media class in one voice was using the, you know, reduced Jewish vote for Labour as a stick with which to beat the Labour Party. Now, when you see a reduction in the Muslim vote for Labour, look at the spin and look at the meaning that it's being assigned. Rather than looking at the issues which are driving that breakdown of a relationship, you know, some of which are going to be like a little bit more local, but the, you know, lion's share of it is very much to do with a clear moral disgust at Keir Starmer's positioning, effectively giving Israel a carte blanche to commit war crimes, as long as it's done in a legal way. Nonsense, farcical position. It's then being seen as, oh, you know, these Muslims, you know, injecting a sort of backwards, insular form of community politics. No, these are Muslims who quite rightly have a profound moral objection to not only the genocidal war in Gaza, but the way in which our political class has enabled and emboldened that genocidal war. But because of how powerful the force of Islamophobia and racism is amongst our political and media class, that democratic rejection of a foreign policy position is looked at as though it's something sinister. So I'm not surprised that that's coming from Trevor Phillips. In my opinion, he has a track record of, you know, Islamophobic tropes when it comes to thinking about British Muslim citizens of this country. So I'm not surprised that he was coming out with this kind of nonsense.
We had been talking about doing a sort of lighter weight show being at a bank holiday, but we're actually going to go 10 minutes over because we've got two more stories to get through, but I'm going to try and blast through them. They're both quite entertaining, I have to say. Last week, we showed you how New York cops used the existence of a bike lock to try and prove student protesters weren't really students. Well, they found new evidence. The students, and you won't believe this, had books.
Extremely prepared. And let's talk about Columbia. Let's talk about Hamilton Hall, right? A book on terrorism.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And I've said it before, that there is somebody, whether it's paid, not paid, but they are radicalizing our students.
Yes, as evidence, these people were dangerous radicals. That cop really did hold up an image of A Very Short Introduction to Terrorism. Now, you probably recognize that type of book. Oxford University Press published them on pretty much every topic. This is how they describe the introduction to terrorism on their website. It discusses recent changes in terrorism, such as the emergence of ISIS and the upsurge in individual suicide action. It's not really encouraging the readers to do it, by the way. Looks at the impact and consequences of several recent terrorist attacks, including those in Brussels, Paris, Nice, and Rouen. Again, I don't think it's telling you how to do one of those yourself. Answers pertinent questions. What is terrorism? Is it war? Is democracy especially vulnerable to terrorist attacks? What can we do to stop it? And explores the impact of increased terrorism on society, including debates surrounding the erosion of civil liberties. Other editions of Very Short Introduction, which might be of interest to the NYPD, include A Very Short Introduction to Violence or A Very Short Introduction to Organized Crime. Possession of either of these would be presumably evidence that you're sort of a member of the mafia about to shoot someone because they haven't paid back your debt or their debts to you. Ash, I mean, I thought it was quite ridiculous when we saw the bike chain last week, but holding up A Very Short Introduction to Terrorism. It is quite difficult to take these people seriously.
Michael, I can't believe you're making light of such a serious issue. I mean, A Very Short Introduction to Terrorism. That's all Osama bin Laden needed. And look what happened.
That's what we had in those caves under the mountain, was just sort of all the most sinister, very short introductions that one can order on Amazon.com.
I mean, yeah, he had that and, you know, gigabytes of pornography. I mean, I think that was probably a terrible combination. I mean, what's funny, not funny, haha, but like interesting, is that this is exactly the same strategy that Israel has used with regards to Gaza. So when the IDF have performed what's called clearing operations in Gaza, which basically means after bombing the living daylights out of residential neighborhoods, sending in ground troops. There have then been these absurd claims about, we found, you know, the Hamas guidebook to anti-Semitism and violence in a three-year-old's bedroom. This just shows, you know, how much Hamas have infiltrated, you know, the homes and families of Gaza, that even three-year-olds are reading this material. I mean, I'm being facetious, but not by very much. And, you know, it seems that the NYPD have very much learned from the IDF in how to conduct an absolute car crash of a PR operation. I mean, it's ridiculous.
All right, I've got another stupid story for you, Ash, that I want your opinion on. The re-election of Sadiq Khan by a decent majority was a relief to many, but not everyone was reassured. Former GB News loudmouth and alleged serial catfisher Dan Wootton said this: four more years of the divisive and hate-filled Sadiq Khan, London will continue its rapid decline. Many folk, including me, won't be here by the next election. Why stay for no-go zones, exploding crime, anarchists running riot on the street, a war on cars, and dying nightlife? And just keep up this image for a moment, because I don't think that is Sadiq Khan. It's sort of an Asian man with grey hair that looks quite different to Sadiq Khan. And behind him is a sort of strange image. I'm not even sure if that's London, but everything's on fire. I'm not sure what this is from. Maybe an AI-generated image, anyway. Dan Wootton isn't the only right-wing provocateur leaving the capital. Lawrence Fox tweeted this: I am pleased I made the decision earlier this year to leave this shithole in anticipation of Sadiq Khan victory. He has turned this once great city into a violent ghetto. I look forward to spending my days in what remains of this green and pleasant land from July. I will not miss the terrorist marches or the Stasi policing or the 20 mile per hour zones. No more motorist hating car fights. No more low traffic neighborhoods. No more surveillance state. No more machetes. No more dead kids. I will still work here. Oh, thank God we'll still see some of him. I will not sleep here anymore. London is unrecognizable as a British city, let alone our capital city, and I'd rather spend the rest of my days with people I have something in common with, other very divorced dads with low social skills who care about England and her needs more than conflicts thousands of miles away. If Lawrence Fox felt London was going in such a bad direction, he of course could have stood for election himself. Oh wait, he did. Fox stood to be a London Assembly member at last week's mayoral elections or local elections. He got 0.6% of the vote. 0.6% of the vote. Now, another sore loser this weekend was Britain First's Paul Golding. He did this as Khan began his victory speech.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Golding had good reason to be in a huff. His racist party scored fewer votes than comedy candidate Count Binface, whose top policy is to reinstate CFACs. Ash, will you be missing Dan Wootton and Lawrence Fox? I suppose he was. How will he still be working here? Does he have a job? I suppose it has maybe like a podcast with other people who got kicked off GB News because they're too extreme. These guys seem unhappy. Puts a smile on my face reading these tweets from these quite grotesque man. What do you think?
The image is spectacular. Look at that. One, that is not Sadiq Khan, all right? That is some random uncle who lives in Finchley and is settling down in the suburbs. But two, even if it is Sadiq Khan, why does it look like he's about to drop the most fire mixtape of all time? That after trading barbs with Susan Hall, you know, he's about to release a mixtape which is like, Susan Hall, keep my name out of your fucking mouth. Like, he looks like he is about to, you know, drop 96 bars of revenge. Like, I can't believe that Dan Wootton has found a way to make, you know, whatever random South Asian uncle, I mean, he might even be a relative of mine, look like one of the most hard battle rappers that has ever existed. So well done, Dan Wootton, you finally produced something of value. As for this, you know, far-right huffy response of, you know, I will no longer live in London now that Sadiq Khan has won again. London has its problems, and I'm not someone who glosses over what they are. It is extortionately expensive to live here. We have huge problems with inequality. Mental health care provision is absolutely in the toilet, and what that means for people, particularly with substance abuse issues, people who are traumatized from acts of violence and are, you know, at high risk of committing acts of violence. Those are all things which are really, really bad in London. One thing that's great about London is that electorally we keep giving the likes of Lawrence Fox a bloody nose. And if that means that they want to turn their backs on the city for, you know, once and for all and break up with us, I think I speak for everyone when I say goodbye. It makes me so sad to see you leave. And you know what? I'm so heartbroken that you might have to really give me some space to be able to move on. You know, maybe it's just best I don't hear from you for many decades, maybe, because I just will not be able to get over you otherwise. So, yeah, Dan Wootton, Lawrence Fox, heartbreak.
Looking more closely at the image, I think he has typed into sort of an AI image generator, please show me Sadiq Khan with London burning behind him. And that's a sort of very strange image that came up with. I mean, if anything, as a consolation, it's better than Dan Wootton sort of typing into the AI generator, I want to see this D-list celebrity in their underpants. Not that I'm saying he's ever done that, but D-list celebrities in their underpants. You know, there's a history there. Ash Sarkar, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Look, I don't know why you're judging people typing D-list celebrities in their underpants into the AI generator. I've had a lot of time on my hands, okay? Like, it's been a boring rainy weekend. I've had nothing else to do.
Thank you everyone for watching this evening. Come back tomorrow for another stream. For now, you've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.